We're talking about escape in this hour. And one of the most searing stories of escape is Luis Alberto Urrea's book, The Devil's Highway. It's a true story of 26 Mexican men who tried to cross the Sonoran Desert into the U.S. back in 2001. Only 12 of them survived. The others are known today as the Yuma 14. Urrea's book won multiple awards when it came out, and there's a new 10th anniversary edition. Unfortunately, the story is just as current as ever. Today, we revisit Urrea's conversation with Jim Fleming and this passage.
They were burned nearly black, their lips huge and cracking, what paltry drool still available to them spuming from their mouths in a salty foam as they walked. Their eyes were cloudy with dust, almost too dry to blink up a tear. Their hair was hard and stiffened by old sweat, standing in a crown from their scalps. Old sweat because their bodies were no longer sweating. They were drunk from having their brains baked in the pan. They were seeing God and devils. And they were dizzy from drinking their own urine, the poisons clogging their systems. They were beyond rational thought. Visions of home fluttered through their minds, soft green bushes, waterfalls, children, music. They were walking now for water, not salvation, just a drink. They whispered it to each other as they staggered into parched pools of their own shadows, forever spilling downhill before them. Just one drink, brothers. Water. Cold water.
This is pretty vivid writing about a day that is extraordinary. This is, what, May 2001?
Yeah, May 2001.
Who were these men?
They were subsistence farmers for the most part from the state of Veracruz. They were coffee sharecroppers, basically, who tried to make a small living with family plots of coffee beans. One of the men was an employee of Pepsi. He was working at a bottling plant carrying crates of bottles, and he had been laid off from his job. The other men were suffering financially when the coffee prices dropped and they suddenly couldn't make enough money on their small plots to feed their families.
So they decided as a group that they would try their luck in the States?
Well, they were recruited. You know, one of the ironies of what's happening on the border now is that our beefed up interdiction policies that have closed down the traditional corridors of illegal immigration, which are the urban corridors for the most part, San Diego, the Nogales area, the El Paso area, and so forth, they are now fairly tightly sealed. So these policies of the Border Patrol, although effective in the urban corridor, have pushed walkers into the wilder corridors that are more dangerous. Because this policy has put them in places that are harder to get through, it has helped to build the human smuggling industry, which is based now on the narco smuggling operations along the border. And these men sent a man down to recruit them, and this man is known as a hooker, un enganchador. Hooking is in fishing, not prostitution.
Right.
And he made his presence felt. He was a local that some of them knew, and he seduced them. He whispered great tales of easy living in the North, and he made them these offers that they would be transported north at a great cost, which they couldn't afford. And the genius of the smuggling operation is that you sign up for this, and in their magnanimous humanity, they lend you the money to come north. And then you are trapped because you are working for them. They were charged 15% interest compounded monthly on the money that they were lent.
And that's where this story begins. They were soliciting people to go across the border and travel the Devil's Highway. Were the guides, in fact, employees of the drug industry?
The guy that I write about specifically in my book, the leader of this group, a guy known as Mendez, had been offered apparently work in the drug syndicates, and he turned them down. He said he didn't want to hurt anybody, which I think is an amazing
considering
comment
that 14 people died as a result of his actions. That's
yeah. But you know, when you see his story, he was not dissimilar from the people who came to walk.
Tell me what happened here.
You know, everybody's wondered that. I think it was a series of catastrophes, all minor, that added up to a major horror. And The first of the catastrophes was that our boy Mendes had been training, and he had a trainer named Maradona. And Maradona did not show up that morning to guide. So Mendes, in his bravado, took over. They headed north on the walking path. They walk at night to try to avoid the heat. They got to Bluebird Pass perfectly. They were there at 11 o'clock at night on schedule. They began to walk down the pass in the darkness, and they were illuminated by spotlights. When the spotlights hit them, Mendes and all of his charges panicked, thinking they'd been caught by the Border Patrol, and they ran. They ran west. Unfortunately, they ran far enough west that they ran to the other side of a ridgeline between them and Bluebird Pass, and some of them dropped their water. They regrouped after midnight and decided to head on to the next pass, because there's a total of three passes that take you to Ajo. But they were one ridgeline removed, and they started walking, and they could not find the pass. So they decided to walk farther, and they could not find the next pass. So they waited for dawn, which was a terrible error, and started walking. At that moment, when dawn came, there was an unexpected heat wave, and they were suddenly walking in 120, 130 ground temperature degrees with no cover, very little water, and they started to become disoriented and ended up walking almost all the way back to the Mexican border.
And that's where the Yuma 14 died. You know, the narrative arc of this story on the face of it's pretty obvious. The migrants are the good guys, the coyotes, the Border Patrol, the bad guys. But your book paints a more complicated picture than that.
Well, you know, I felt that my charge was to try to present a human story that broke down by happenstance into these three groups: the smugglers, the smuggled, and the law enforcement people hunting them. All of them, I realized at some point, aliens to this landscape. All of them recruited in different ways into their various forms of service, and all of them then cast into this really vicious atmosphere that they had to try to survive and somehow master if they were going to live. So, you know, if anybody's a villain, I would think it's the people who run the whole smuggling operation. Certainly, I learned from the Border Patrol agents something that surprised me, which was, you know, I went in believing that they were jackbooted thugs, you know. But I realized that they did not have hatred or anger toward the walkers. They had hatred and anger toward the coyote smugglers. The kind of rage that those agents feel is something that you have to experience to really understand it. As one of them said to me, "You try carrying a dead 6-year-old girl in your arms out of the desert and tell me you don't have feelings about it." You know, they've seen the ravages. They regularly see horrible things like pregnant women abandoned to die. I've been told stories of finding a dead pregnant woman with the fetus still stirring in her belly. I've been told stories of, you know, finding a dead nursing mother with an infant trying to nurse on her still. Just awful stories that I can't even begin to fathom of cruelty.
Wow. There's a section toward the end of your book. Would you read that? Maybe the part that, as you say, reads like poetry?
Yeah. Naum Landa Ortiz's testimony reads like modern poetry. "We were in the trees, trying to hide from the sun, and they would yell to me, 'There's a guy dead over here, and there's a guy dead over here.' There must have been 30 of us out there, and 20 of us died. By Monday, we were all dead. I was hiding under that tree out there. I saw people in despair. I saw them without water. I don't know why I survived. Maybe it's a miracle. Some of them just died of desperation. Some of them went insane. Some of them lost their minds. You could hear them screaming. Some fell all alone. I heard one guy screaming, daring the Border Patrol to come find him. Stupid things like that. He was desperate. He started singing. We were drinking urine. We were ripping open cactus. Some of the boys were saying you could cut the thirst with a cactus. The majority of them died that day. I was going to die this morning. I have spines from those pinches cactuses all over me."
It's hard to read something like that, to hear something like that, and realize it happens over and over again.
It's happening right now, probably.
Was there a special reason why you wrote this story, why you went after it?
Yeah, actually, you know, that scene that's actually near the very end of the book when the secretaries in the Mexican consulate light votive candles when I'm looking at the death packets of the dead men, and it so haunted me that I was looking at the pictures of these guys and their autopsies and so forth, and I was smelling the smell of their rotting bodies because each packet has a Ziploc sandwich baggie with their personal effects in it. So they were all soaked with the fluids of the bodies as they rotted. So I was sitting here with the pictures of their death and their doom, smelling them, holding things like scapulars or a plastic comb with hair in it. And then these women begin to light candles, and I thought, well, what a lovely Catholic gesture, until I realized it was to kill the smell. That did it. That put me over the edge, and I knew I had to tell the story.
Luis Alberto Urrea is the author of The Devil's Highway. Jim Fleming spoke with him.